Today, what we are doing and what we are supposed to be doing.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
By the way, before I get to the topic today, that's a really odd idiomatic expression, what we are supposed to be doing. I use supposed the same way I use the word ought, what we ought to be doing in that case. And yet it's supposed, well, anyway, you get the idea. It would be an interesting idiom to study. Someday we'll get to that. But what I mean by it today is that there is a contrast between the things we actually focus on trying to accomplish and the things we're supposed to accomplish as human beings, but as certainly as people who are created by God and care about why he put us here. And I have a particular topic that sort of forces this issue to the front of my mind, and I'm going to beg your indulgence today for me to be able to talk about it this way, because I'm approaching my birthday, my next birthday. I'll stop talking about the years. I think that bothers some people. But I'm approaching my next birthday, and I just want to cover what I want to cover today. So if you're willing to hang in there with me, I think the topic is well worth bringing up. And let me mention what provokes this particular form of the question for me. It's a conundrum that I've faced since I was in high school, probably before high school, in dealing with God's response to the Tower of Babel. And I mean, since I read scripture then, I have always had this little nagging thing in the back of my mind that has said, that doesn't seem right. And then I have found a way to make it work theologically for me, and even anthropologically, like how it relates to human beings and how we fit into God's creation and so on, that makes sense of it. And still leaves this nagging problem with me for why God says it the way he does. It just doesn't seem quite right. And so some of those things have come to a head, and partially in response to some of the things I've been reading and listening to. I go back and forth between an audiobook and a printed version of The Human Condition that I'm finishing now. And in reading that book, some of these things have been provoked, but also in a whole list of other ideas that have been sort of pushed on me in the recent weeks, I've come to a realization about some of that that I hope to resolve in the conversation, in the talk today. So again, I beg your indulgence. I'm going to go down the road the way I like to go down it, because it's interesting to me. You might find this hard to believe, but normally I'm trying to find ways to talk about these topics that I think are significant and important, but also have relatability and some way to connect with you, somebody who wants to listen to it. Today, I'm not trying to ignore you, obviously. I want it to relate to you. I want it to fit, and I think it will. But honestly, I'm approaching a subject that I just want to talk about, and so that's what we're going to do today. So to begin this and talk about the contrast that I think is most important, we have to look at the Enlightenment project. We have to sort of understand what the Enlightenment was about and what really changed, where that set our sights, and the contrast between that, where God, you know, where we set our sights in the Enlightenment project, and where our sights are actually supposed to be set, what we're actually supposed to be doing. So we accepted this certain level of responsibility for the world in the time of the Enlightenment, the emergence of science and our control of the world and so on. We accepted a certain kind of responsibility for working in the world and understanding the world and describing the world and all those things. And then I think there's a contrast between that and the responsibility we actually have. So the conundrum that I had about Babel that sort of sets the conversation for us is the statement when, you know, men had gathered together coming from the east and they had settled in the plain of Babel, wherever it is, and they had Shinar, the plain of Shinar, I think it's called, and I'm not looking at the story right this moment, but they said to themselves, we will build a city and a tower that reaches up to God. You know, that's the idea. And God comes down and in response to this, separates them from each other, gives them different languages. And, you know, this is the story we have for looking back and saying, oh, that's why we all speak different languages. It's to keep people from cooperating too much with each other. Because if they do, and this is, you know, when God explains why he does what he does in the story that we're given in Genesis 11, he says nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them, meaning nothing they propose to do, and sometimes it's translated this way, I think this is the meaning, it's really hard to get around it, nothing they propose to do will be impossible. You know, man will be able to accomplish anything he sets his mind to. Well, obviously, there's a problem with that statement coming from God about men if it's taken literally. So, you know, fine, I'm willing to encapsulate it in the pragmatics of actual language and say he just means the things they will conceive of doing. They'll be able to do it, and, you know, they'll be able to do pretty much anything they settle on doing. But the reality of the world is that we can't. There are just a bajillion things we can't do. And then we get to the Enlightenment and we start thinking again, maybe we can. You know, we've gone to the moon, which we would have thought of as impossible as anything conceivable up until we did it. And then we did it. We went to the moon. That's why the whole world wanted to stop and see when we landed on the moon, when we launched, what happened with the astronauts in between. It was the glorious moment when we proved we could do anything. So in the Enlightenment and all the science that followed it, we sort of proved that maybe it is the case that we can do anything we're thinking about. And now you have, you know, Elon Musk talking about going to Mars and other people, from Bezos to whoever else has a social media company, deciding to establish a rocket company and say we're going to name it something that's going to take us to the stars. We're going to go to other stars, and I'll bring that back in the end of the conversation, the thing that's just not going to happen. But whatever. There are things we propose to do that are, we always have known this, difficult, almost inconceivable. But, you know, given the language in response to Babel and given the Enlightenment, maybe, you know, maybe we should think of it as actually possible. But I just want to make the point here that in the real world, the world we inhabit, even the Enlightenment world, and because we're in the Enlightenment world, because we know things that we didn't know before, there are things we propose to do which will. And I don't just mean this in practical terms. I mean, in reality, be eternally held from us. We cannot do them. How do you put those two things together? It may not even seem important to anybody but me. But in reality, it's a fairly important question. The nature of humanity is that our you know, this is the expression, our reach exceeds our grasp. That we long for things we can't obtain. And yet the whole point of our creation is that we're supposed to be able to obtain the thing that we're given, which is the creation itself. We have dominion in that creation. So can we do that stuff or not do that stuff? And in the process of it, I don't just want to answer some, you know, an esoteric question. Do we have infinite power? Obviously we don't. We're not omnipotent. That's fine. I'm not just answering that question. It's the reality that we are like the people who settled in Shinar and said, let's build a city that reaches up to God himself, to the heavens themselves, and build a tower in it. We are that people. We are constantly reaching out to go further. And in doing that, accomplishing miraculous, marvelous things. But are they the things we ought to be grasping? Are we reaching for the right things, and are we grasping the right things? So on half the discussion, I just want to talk about the direction we are going, what we are accomplishing, and how we perceive of what we are accomplishing. And then on the other half, talk about what we ought to be accomplishing or what we ought to be doing. So on the side of what we're actually doing, that's where I want to talk about the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment Project. Because as a consequence of the Enlightenment, starting in the 1600s or so and just moving forward from there, everything changes for humanity. Everything certainly changes in Western society, but because it changes in Western society, it changes for the world. We're interwoven. I don't mean by that we make the whole world better because we're so smart. I mean, there's no having a change in a major part of the culture or civilization without influencing everything else in the world. And so what I'm talking about with the Enlightenment Project, and this is in language largely borrowed from Alistair MacIntyre, the nature of the Enlightenment Project was to seek a justification, and I mean by it a rational justification or an empirical justification, so by science and observation and research, or by thinking really hard and logically and close and tight, you know, so rational or empirical kind of justification, but it's rational justification in their language originally for beliefs independent of God. Why do we think that? And what we wanted to say in the Enlightenment was, let's get an answer to that question that doesn't require going back to the Bible. Let's get an answer to that question that doesn't mean we have to go to the priest. So let's study it out for ourselves. After all, the light of knowledge and wisdom is in every man, and if we think about it hard enough or study it hard enough, we should be able to find an answer. And so the Enlightenment Project becomes this project of seeking for the justification for our beliefs without having to rely on a belief in God. It didn't mean they didn't believe in God. It didn't mean they rejected God. It just meant they were looking for answers where they could say, oh, and I can show you this. I can demonstrate it. I don't have to go to the priest to get approval for it. It wasn't necessarily atheistic at all, but methodologically, it was as if it was atheistic. We want to find answers and not talk to God in the process. Like, you know, maybe God's there, but we don't want to open the door to talk to him to figure out the answers to these things, because that would not be man's knowledge. That would just be revelation, and we want something more than that. So the steps that we took in the Enlightenment to get there, and I've talked about this before in previous episodes, but I want to give a little more detail to it today and share with you some of my favorite passages in this journey. Not because I love the authors, but because I love understanding the history of this transition. When we talk about it theoretically or abstractly, we just don't appreciate how tied together these movements of history were. So I want to read specific little quotations from some of these transitional figures during this period. I'll read two or three of them. We're not going to read from all of them. So, but the first step in that whole Enlightenment project or process, the thing that sort of set the machine in motion, literally, for us during the Enlightenment, to start the Enlightenment movement, was converting the material world, in our minds, I mean, converting the material world from this dramatic stage where God's play was unfolding in our lives, and, you know, he established and he set all the pieces in their place, and they all perform their functions so that we can come out on the stage and do what he's prescribed for us, even if you're not a determinist, do what he's prescribed for us in the role we play as human beings on this dramatic stage of the material world. It converted from that into this mindless, empty box, a machine, really, which is the way we think of the modern world today. It's all these particles in motion, and they just interact with each other. And, you know, he goes through Copernicus and the whole Copernican revolution, different way of seeing the universe, the solar system. So it's heliocentric. He goes through Galileo and the invention of the telescope, as a telescope, that is, and being able to see that other bodies do revolve around things other than the sun, other than the Earth. And most importantly, comes down to Isaac Newton and his explanation of gravity, his formulation of this law of gravity, which has effect not only on the earth, you know, this is why apples fall to the ground, but on the heavenly bodies themselves. So that we're no longer seeing this divide in the universe between the heavens and the earth the way we had before, but instead saying, you know, the laws that obtain here obtain there as well. It's all the same. It's just this giant machine that we live in, and we're part of the machine. And that transition, that's a huge transition for mankind. And I sometimes say this and people are like, oh, please. I mean, you're philosophers, you think your ideas are so important. But it's not like that. I mean, just consider how you would have to think differently about the entire world and the way the world works, why it does what it does, if you didn't even have a concept of gravity. You didn't even have a way to think about why we stick to the ground. What would you think of that? And there are answers to that question. If we were doing a whole survey on that, I would come back and explain some of those. But the reality is, it's a transformative thing when you say it's not the hand of God. It's not some mysterious desire to be part of the ground. It's not some teleological, some end-based conclusion that's supposed to be what we are in the end. It is just a force, an impersonal force that constantly draws bodies together, all of them together. And because the earth is so enormous, it draws us, you know, so on. Once you depersonalize the nature of the material world like that, our way of thinking about everything changes. Again, changes from being this world drama that's going on to being just events that are happening, transpiring one after another as a result of the ones that came before them. In that period of time, Descartes is also writing. So sort of between Galileo and Newton, Descartes is also writing. And in his way of seeing the universe, which I'm not going to do his philosophy. I want to. I love doing it. But I'm not going to do it today. But in his dualism between the body and the soul, that the body is one thing, the mind is a completely different kind of thing, obviously, they're completely distinct. In his mind-body dualism, he preserves in that world where now we see impersonal forces driving the universe, he preserves room for our souls. He preserves room for a mind that doesn't obey the law of gravity, doesn't need to obey the law. It's not a part of that. So we have room to keep thinking of how Christianity fits in and how spirituality fits in and how the significance of things is different from talking about them as physical objects related to each other and so on. So really, most of the values that we would have or the things we were concerned about that way, we didn't have to change at all. Descartes preserves the space for that. There are others too, but I mean, Descartes is the guy we know. So there is a second step that comes, and it doesn't go immediately to the soul. So when can we eliminate the soul and bring it into the machine of the universe? It doesn't go that directly. After we've adopted the view that the whole universe is working according to these principles of mechanics, you know, that Newton's given us, what do we need to change next? You know, we have all these animated objects, these animals especially, that all move differently than rocks. They do things differently than everything else. And they do things, you know, with an intentionality that's very similar to ours. And so we don't think of them in the same way we think of the rest of the material world, even though Descartes is willing to think of them as fleshy machines. So they should be following the same rules of physics that everything else follows, right? That's where we should be going. So we have to go from physics now to biology and say, how can we make biology impersonal? Because when I'm looking at a dog, I see another creature of God. You know, I see something that smiles back at me when I smile at it, even if it's snarling. Whatever it's doing, it looks like, you know, something very similar to me. So how do I, if I'm in the Enlightenment Project, and I say, why do animals do what they do? I kind of have to say, well, God's given them this thing that allows them to interact with us in the way they do. Unless I can find some mechanism that brings biology into the world of physics, you know, brings it into the same kind of mechanistic world that Newton gave us for the material world. And obviously, that's Charles Darwin. And so this is the first thing I'm going to read to you in the sections, the little selections I have to read to you. So in the Enlightenment, animals are the next thing we fold into the mechanical world. And they just become part of the mechanical world. And it's with evolution, with the concept of evolution. Not a brand new idea. It's an idea that had been around for over 2,000 years in Aristotle and before that. But it's newly adopted as something that's reasonable, something that we could embrace, because now our minds want to be able to conceive of the world around us in a way that's graspable, comprehensible. So we're going to be able to understand the biological world. And so I'm going to read to you this whole section, the very last words in The Origin of Species, the work that came out in 1859 that allows Darwin to say, you know, I think animals are just part of the physical world too. They look more complicated than rocks, but they're really just very complicated rocks in a different way. You know what I mean? So from The Origin of Species, the last paragraph is this. It is interesting, he says, to contemplate a tangled bank clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent upon each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws. This is the whole point. It comes under the rule of nature's law. So, been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the conditions of life and from use and disuse, a ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life and, as a consequence, to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. These are all those elements of the laws that he says are being brought to bear on this theory that he has proposed. Then he continues and he says, thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we're capable of conceiving, namely, the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its separate powers, several, he says, powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. The whole magic of the word for him is that that evolution is mechanistic. It's the natural procedure that's going to come from the conditions that have arisen in the natural world. And his tipping of the hat to the Creator is, I don't know that it's begrudging, but I suspect it's begrudging. It certainly is by 1871, 12 years later, when he writes The Descent of Man, it's obvious he doesn't hold that view anymore. But in this one, I think he may be begrudgingly or hedging his statements to say, look, there's still room for you to believe in God. He starts it. But once he starts it, it's just like a rock rolling downhill. These are the laws of nature that took over and produced animals to be what they are. So by the time we get to 1859, and the population just soaks this up, eats it up. Of course, there's resistance among those who have faith, but the culture as a whole adopts this view, and evolution becomes the paradigm by which we understand all change over the next 50 years or so, and it still is to this day. Anyway, my point is, he's taking on this view about biology that then forces us to see not only the physical world, but the biological world as just this mechanism that's operating around us according to fixed laws. But he's excluded man from the discussion. This is, you know, the origin of species, not the origin of man. We're not talking about that. 12 years later, of course, he pens The Descent of Man, 1871, publishes The Descent of Man. And this is his final paragraph. Again, all of these, and I'll give you one later on a different subject altogether, these are all the very last words that are in these books. So they are the conclusion of the author. So in his summary and conclusion, he says, I won't read you this entire thing, but you know, he knows he has to be combative. On The Descent of Man, he's saying we also are evolved from lower species to become what we are. there's a lot of racist and prejudicial statements in what he says in his last paragraphs, because he considers barbarians to be of actually a semi-lower species at this point. He's still thinking the way a lot of people did through the mid-20th century, unfortunately, and tragically, in consequence for lots of people during that time. But so he talks about barbarians, and he says, I don't know why I would be surprised that I evolved from somebody as barbarian as these people who live in the South Pacific. He says things like that. But then he adds to it this. So he said, I would as soon be descended from that heroic little monkey who braved, and he's speaking about a monkey here. It's not a racist statement. He's actually talking about a monkey. He says, I would as soon be descended from that heroic little monkey who braved his dreaded enemy in order to save the life of his keeper, or from that old baboon who, descending from the mountains, carried away in triumph his young comrade from a crowd of astonished dogs, as I would be from a savage. Now, this sounds like it's racist, but this part's not. You'll hear he's attacking us. As I would be from a savage who delights to torture his enemies, offers up bloody sacrifices, practices infanticide without remorse, treats his wives like slaves, knows no decency, or is haunted by the grossest superstitions. All of those, you know, he's just talking about his neighbors, you know, when he's saying all of that stuff. And he's saying, I'd rather be evolved from an animal than I would to say I was related to these people who live the way they do around me, meaning we need to let go of our old beliefs and come to the conclusion that we are just a part of nature, just like everything else. Now, why his moral, convictions would be so important if that were the case is a whole different matter for discussion. I get it. I understand the hypocrisy that I would say is involved in that statement. But then listen to what he says just after this. He says, man may be excused for feeling some pride at having risen, though not through his own exertions, to the very summit of the organic scale. Meaning, let's view ourselves evolution in an evolutionary way and say, why not just be proud of the fact that we evolved further than everybody else? This is what he's saying. And the fact of having thus risen, instead of having been originally placed there, may give him hope for a still higher destiny in the distant future. Who knows what we'll evolve into next, which is the Superman kind of idea that Nietzsche will play off of. So anyway, he concludes this, though. We must, however, acknowledge, as it seems to me, that man, with all the noble qualities, with sympathy which feels for the most debased, with benevolence which extends not only to other men but to the humblest living creature, with his godlike intellect, which has penetrated into, this is the foundation of everything, the movements and constitution of the solar system, with all these exalted powers, man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. My point in reading you that section is to say how clearly they themselves, in developing these ideas, knew that they were doing the same thing. We're explaining physics, now we don't need to talk about God in physics. We're explaining biology, now we don't need to talk about God in biology. And we're accomplishing the same goal, which is not to say there's no God, even though for some of them, they did believe that there was no God. For most, it was simply to say we don't have to appeal to a blind revelation in order to understand where we came from, because the whole thing's a machine and we can study the machine and figure out what's happening with it. So I'm not trying to criticize the push against God here, even though it deserves thorough criticism. So I am definitely on the other side of this. I mean, I believe God is in every moment keeping us in existence. So I have no qualms whatsoever about saying I'm completely dependent on a miracle-performing God in every single moment of my life. Don't hear me wrong. But that's not the point of this discussion. The point is what we are doing as humanity. And what we're doing fits with what we were created to do, which was exercise dominion over the earth. Now, I'm not saying we're doing it the right way. That's why I said I want to contrast what we are doing with what we ought to be doing. But what we are doing and what we ought to be doing do have something in common, that we're supposed to be exercising dominion. We are trying to do that, and we're doing it in ever more powerful ways because of the movement of the Enlightenment. And the final push in all of that, by the way, is, you know, we've gone through physics and we've gone through biology. Then the thing that remains is the thing that Descartes had carved out and made separate, the mind of man, you know, the soul and its nature. So the final push is to get thoughts, one way or another, into the mechanical system. So one way you do that with thoughts, with the mind, with the soul, is by, you know, eliminating it, just saying it doesn't actually exist. And so they, you know, your thoughts are just synapses firing, or the mind is the brain. They are the same thing. So that's one option. I'm not really going to talk about that. Reductive, eliminative materialism, that kind of stuff. It's not the topic for today. But that is one of the ways people do it. Oh, you know, I'm going to study the brain, and therefore I will understand why people think the way they do. There are influences of our brain on our thoughts, and so it's a reasonable thing to study, and we actually do learn more when we learn more about the brain. So it's still an expression of exercising more and more dominion over stuff, right? On the other hand, the other way to get thoughts into this category where physics and biology have gone in the Enlightenment is to bring them into the realm of comprehension as one of those other things that follows the laws of nature, that follows the rules of the world around it. So, everything is about that. We want to comprehend all of these domains in the world as following laws. So rocks in the material world, animal life just follows evolution. Rocks follow gravity, animal life follows evolution, humanity follows animal life, and the mind is just another piece of animal life. So what should we look for in it? And this comes in Freud. This is the point of Sigmund Freud and his work. What makes him so significant is not the application of his theory to psychoanalytics. Everybody has a different perspective on psychoanalytics and on human psychology than the actual thing that Freud proposes motivates us to do the things that we do. But everybody's version is a model of the same thing Freud first and foremost tried to accomplish in his description of human psychology. And I have a very long selection here to read. I'm not going to make you suffer through all of that. See, I'm not completely inconsiderate of you. But there are parts of it that I just have to read to you in this. They're too important not to read. And it's the conclusion to his work called The Future of an Illusion, where he uses science and psychology as the contrast to religion, which is false. And religion is always deceptive, and it's always just convincing people that they have what doesn't really exist because they want it. And that's the only reason they have it, is because they want it, and so on. But what we should do instead is trust science. And so he has this little argument right at the end of the book. And again, I'm going to read you his last lines from the book. Right at the end of the book, about how science should be the thing that we trust instead of religion anymore. And some people will respond and say, well, you shouldn't trust science either because those people are always changing their mind about things. I mean, one year you're supposed to drink wine, it makes you healthier. The next year you drink wine, it kills you. People still say that today, that kind of stuff, right? He wasn't answering the wine theory thing. I mean, you know, that's recent stuff. But, you know, this diet works. No, that diet's terrible. That diet works. Science contradicts itself. We shouldn't trust it. So he's responding to that criticism. But he says this, but this is to disregard several factors which are of decisive importance for the understanding of a scientific work. And the reason I'm reading this to you is because by the time we get to Freud in the early 20th century, he writes this in 1927, by the time we get to Freud in the early 20th century, the confidence in science is so high. We think it can solve every problem. If we just give it enough resources, it can do anything. And it's during this time that we're developing atomic sciences, understanding radiation, starting to get into the inside of the atom, and finally producing a nuclear weapon within 20 years of this, before 20 years. So, I mean, this is, science is moving the earth at this time, and Freud is its advocate, right? And he's advocating for it in that domain where people had carved out a little niche and said, but don't touch my mind, don't touch my soul, don't touch my religion. And he says, it's just part of the system, right? So he's saying, trust science over everything. And somebody says to him, I don't think we should trust science that much. And he says, but your objections to this are inadequate. It's ignoring some things. In the first place, he says, our organization, that is, our mental apparatus, has been developed precisely in the attempt to explore the external world, and it must therefore have realized in its structure some degree of expediency. There's not a Christian in the world who thinks about the relationship between the human mind and the natural world that wouldn't agree with that statement. God created our mind. God created the world. That's why we can understand the world. That makes sense, but he's saying it about science to say, well, then trust your mind when it's telling you things about nature. So then he says, in the second place, it is itself a constituent part of the world. He says that about the mind. Our mental apparatus is itself a constituent part of the world which we set out to investigate, and it readily admits of such an investigation. The mind can be studied the same way as everything else. Thirdly, the task of science is fully covered if we limit it to showing how the world must appear to us in consequence of the particular character of our organization. And fourthly, the ultimate findings of science, precisely because of the way in which they are acquired, are determined not only by our organization, the organization of science and stuff, but by the things which have affected that organization. Finally, the problem of the nature of the world without regard to our percipient mental apparatus is an empty abstraction, devoid of practical interest. No, he says, our science is not an illusion. That was the ultimate objection. You can't trust science. These people are deceiving themselves. They're just creating an echo chamber where they're saying what they want to hear. And he says, in conclusion, no, our science is no illusion. But an illusion it would be to suppose that what science cannot give us, we can get elsewhere. That closing line is this culmination of the Enlightenment project. There is nothing to pursue in knowledge other than what could be found through our research as people who are investigating the world with the senses that, we would say, God gave us. So the point here is that we have this conception of expanding dominion, which takes the form of ever-increasing control of the material world. So we look at the entire world and with our, and you know, we have finite resources, we get it. So we don't have infinite minds. We have finite minds. We understand some things, don't understand. We can only learn so many things at a time. So our finite resources require us to begin creating boundaries for our studies. So we study physics, and then we study biology, and then we study. So it's not just I'm a philosopher scientist, it's I'm a biologist or I'm a psychologist. We create domains, but those domains are actually expanding the range of our dominion because they give us ways of demarcating where we are going to study and where we're going to stop and where someone else is going to pick it up. And then we can go and read their book and see what they've learned. And as humanity, we will grasp the entirety of the world because we mark it out in longitude and latitude and then mark out the particular point on the globe we want to look at and get a satellite to take a picture of it for us. And now we've comprehended the world. Our expanding dominion is made even more obvious by how we attempt to grasp every single thing that can be known in some part of the studies that we're doing. And all of this, look, all of this understanding and manipulation where we grasp it, we understand what it means, and then we use that, we manipulate it, we turn it to our advantage in some way. All of this understanding and manipulation can be really helpful. As critical as I am of the absurdity of some of the claims, like, well, if you can't find it in science, you can't find it anywhere else at the end of Freud, as much as I just want to jump on that and go, are you kidding me? Are you just paying? I want to do all of that. At the same time, I'm really grateful for all the benefits, the advantages we get from people having worked so hard for the last 400 years to grasp the things that go on in the material world and in biology and in our minds when they're studying psychology. The question remaining, always remaining, after you grab that piece of dirt or you grab that little animal that was running away from you or you sit a client in front of you and grab their mind and say, do you see this little part of what you're thinking and how it, where it came from and where it's going with you? When we're grabbing all this stuff that's in the world that we've studied and dissected and come to understand, the question that still remains and isn't even approached or mildly mitigated by all of that work is, to what end? You know, if I had more time, I would expand into B.F. Skinner at this point. So I'll just put it in summary form by saying, when B.F. Skinner writes in 1972, as a psychologist, a behaviorist, says in 1972 that we have a technology for all these other things. We have a technology to go to the moon. It's the same discussion I just had with you. But when he says it in this abbreviated format, you know, we have a technology to grow food better. We have a technology for all these other things. Why do we still have problems in the world? Because we don't have a good technology for behavior. So if we just had a technology to control people's behavior, as good as the technology we have for building an atomic weapon or for going to the moon, if we had that kind of technology, then we could produce a perfect world. You know, that's what he wanted to do. That was the idea. Now, I'm not saying that literally he thought we would arrive at a perfect world, but that's the idea. It's a utopian kind of vision. Beyond Freedom and Dignity is the name of the book from 1972 that he wrote that says this. Even if we did that, even if we developed the psychology he wanted to develop, you know, where we could actually make people think they wanted what they needed to want so that we could have a perfect society, and then they really want it, because if you think you want it, you do want it, then people are freely pursuing, in the way we would use freedom now, freely pursuing the things that are good for them, and we develop a perfect society out of it. Even if we did all of that, the question that remains is, why bother? I mean, what's it about? What's the advantage? What's the point? What would it accomplish? And if you did try to do it, is there anything it should leave alone? The reason I'm asking that question is the other half of the discussion, which we'll have, you know, next week on my birthday. As we have that discussion, the point is to say, okay, this is what we've been doing, even if Freud wouldn't have said, well, God created us to have dominion, so I'm exercising dominion over another part of the world. Even if he wouldn't have acknowledged it came from God, we are, as humanity, just doing what God put us here to do, which is grab more and more of creation and make sense of it and do with it what we're supposed to do. That's how we take it. That's how we understand it. That's what's happening. We're expanding our dominion, right? But are we? Is that how we're supposed to expand our dominion? Again, I'm always going to be thankful for that, and I hope we keep doing that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I think our responsibility, our actual responsibility, is different from that, and we should probably think of it differently from that. Rather than just comprehending the material world, rather than grasping the other parts figuratively, I think there's something else we're supposed to do with it, something else we're supposed to understand from it. And, you know, it's the basis of a lot of what I live for right now. And so that's what I want to talk about next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.